Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host, Ryan Krause, coming out of the shadows once again to examine the August 30th, 2013 disappearance of 19-year-old college student Bryce Laspisa, who drove off the side of a road alongside Castaic Lake in California and then rumbled down an embankment below in total darkness behind the wheel of a 2003 Toyota Highlander, only to flip at the bottom. When police arrived, they found the back window smashed out and blood drops on the passenger headrest and back seat. But there was no sign of Bryce. Not then, and not ever again since that day. He just vanished into thin air. It's a fascinating tale that seems nearly inexplicable on the surface, but reveals far more clarity lurking beneath. So we have to get out the shovel and dig. We have to go deep, down to the archaeology of nature, because the answers are in the bedrock of evolutionary science. I know, I'm just some idiot who talks about strange things. Yet it's apparent to me that the truth in this case will only be revealed by stripping the events down to what I'll describe as evolutionary GPS. More specifically, we're going to map Bryce's movements to gain an understanding not only about his intentions, but more importantly, the basis for what ails him. Because there's a specific kinetic energy at play in this case, the presence of which Bryce can't hide. There's a chess match going on in his brain, and evolution calls checkmate. So let's move into his background and then jump into the timeline of events. Bryce Laspisa was born and raised in Naperville, Illinois, a city of nearly 147,000 residents. He excelled in sports and did equally as well academically. By all accounts, he was a normal, well-adjusted teen upon graduating high school, seemingly having avoided the pitfalls that come with depression, drug abuse, bullying, and so on. Bryce is described as outgoing, having no trouble making friends or bonding with others, and it also seems his home life was normal. And that's the narrative to which most coverage of this case adheres. Normalcy. The reason for that is it heightens the mystery. It makes something baffling out of something that should be obvious. But to see the truth, we need to strip away all of these extraneous bullshit niceties because they serve as virtual roadblocks. With all due respect to the missing person and family, I will not allow assumptions that defy fact for the sake of retaining perception. Instead, I'm going to identify revealing patterns in Bryce's behavior and identify the meaning inherent within. There's just no hiding from it. You'll see what I mean as the events unfold. Bryce's actions tell a story that contradicts the informational aspect of the case. We're going to hear all about phone calls, conversations, and numerous other anecdotes that add up to absolutely nothing in terms of helping to solve the case in hand. Character equals action. Aristotle said it 2,000 years ago, and it's true today. It doesn't matter what Bryce said to anyone. Not one fucking word. I have the mute button on in my mind. But we'll analyze those conversations for subtext anyhow, and we'll see Bryce telling a much different story than the one his parents claim. This was not a happy young man. His life was not going well. He wanted to die. That was Bryce Laspisa the day he vanished. Something was wrong. It had been. We don't know the origin of the issue, except that it was related to mental illness. And we don't know where he ended up when he disappeared. But we know the journey between. And that's the road we're going to travel. Straight to the truth. So, once Bryce graduates high school in Naperville, Illinois, his parents Karen and Michael plan to move the family to Laguna Niguel in Southern California. Bryce obviously leaves behind family and friends to go on this adventure with his parents, but it's not exactly a giant leap considering many high school graduates are going away somewhere else to live for college anyway. Soon after arriving in California, Bryce enrolls in Sierra College, which is approximately a 7-hour drive from his home. Now, this all seems very innocent on the surface, except that what catches my attention is the assertion by Bryce's parents that they left Illinois to escape the harsh winters for California sunshine, yet as soon as they do, their son plummets into the winter of his existence where things become so bad, it ends in tragedy. They anticipated sunshine, but got rain. And guess what that means? They ignored the storm clouds moving in because it interfered with their desires. They wanted sun, and so they saw sun. But Bryce felt the rain, so they held an umbrella over his head to protect him from it. Yet it still kept raining on him. So, things are supposedly fine with Bryce through high school, and also into the summer of 2013, right before starting his sophomore year at Sierra College. He's young, happy, healthy, and enjoying life with his girlfriend Kim in California. But then suddenly, in the 2 weeks between when he returns to school and classes begin, he falls to pieces. He's drinking heavily and taking the prescription ADHD drug Vyvanse, an amphetamine-based stimulant designed to enhance focus and similar traits for the purpose of improving moods and performance in those troubled by such issues. In fact, Bryce is getting so wasted that his roommate calls his parents to suggest he's concerned. So let's just try to put that into perspective. A male college student called his roommate's parents to say he's worried about the kids drinking. Normal behavior at that age is bragging to each other about who drank more and never telling each other's parents about that kind of shit. In order to be that concerned as a 19-year-old male college student who also drinks, it would have to be really bad. And at the core of the concern that urges him to call is one singular notion. Something awful is going to happen. Right? Think about the times you've seen another person in bad shape and your heart sank because you could just feel that something bad was going to happen. For the roommate to place such a call, it's obviously with the inference that the parents need to know this information for the purpose of acting accordingly. But they don't. Watch what happens here. Like I said, they want to see sun, even when Bryce feels rain. So what does he tell them? Everything is fine. And what do? They let it go, opting to see sunshine instead. But what do we know about people who ignore oncoming storms? Their plight ends in tragedy. When the floodwaters come rolling in psychologically, you have to head for higher ground. You can't stand and fight. You'll get washed away. It happens to Bryce. The only safety from drowning in the valley of emotional turmoil is to seek truth. Because the truth is synonymous with help. That's why alcoholics and drug addicts stand up in meetings and say exactly what the hell they are. They have no time for bullshit because they're so tired of the smell of drowning in it for so long. Truth is at the top of the mountain. That's where victory takes place on earth, in mind and body, in overcoming struggle, surviving the obstacles, reaching the top. Hell is below for a reason, and that's because the dead are beneath our feet. The only truth located there is death. Its doors are always open for business. So Bryce, once he begins to drown, needs to ask somebody to throw him a rope. Bryce Laspisa is going to tell his mother, on the last days he's ever seen alive, that he's coming home, that he has something to tell her. He never does. Bryce never flees to high ground. He decides to drown below. And he's never seen again. Washed away to sweet, blissful ignorance. Or was he? Let's find out. The incident we're about to recount is nothing less than a brutal, non-stop battle for control of cognitive function between humanity and nature, or society versus evolution. That's the basis for so much of the chaos we experience. A profound question of how to reconcile the truth with the perception we prefer to indulge. Heaven for those suffering such ills is release. There's none in this story. At all. The purgatory for that endeavor is denial. That's where Bryce's parents remain. Hell is retention of the secret. Hiding misery beneath the surface of the murky waters. Drowning in it. That's Bryce Laspisa on August 30th. And with that, It's apparent that the symbolism dictates he's literally and figuratively going to go downhill that night, and literally and figuratively heading toward a place where he can permanently hide the misery and retain the secret beneath the murky waters. With that, it shouldn't be a surprise that Bryce is going to drive straight down a hillside toward a lake, flip over halfway there, and disappear forever. And why does he disappear? Again, it's embedded in the symbolism. He isn't in denial. His parents are. So when his truck flips halfway between the heaven at the top of the hill and the hell of drowning in the waters below, he isn't permitted to be there. So what does he do? Naturally, he vanishes from the purgatory. And why? Because even though it symbolically represents where his parents exist within the issue, they're literally also the people who are first going to be called if he flips his truck. He can't be there. And why? He'd have to face them, which means he has to forego secrecy and will in turn force his parents to abandon denial, which leaves the truth as the only option. Notice that Bryce was unwilling to divulge it up to that point. Why would he start then? That was the end of the line for him. He drove a truck down a hillside toward a lake. The truth was his path to forgiveness. He had to engage his parents in the purgatory by calling them and getting help, whereby both parties would not only experience release or catharsis by way of the truth becoming a mutual understanding, but they could all move on accordingly. That doesn't happen. Bryce Laspisa decided to run and hide, because he always had. But what was so terrible he couldn't face it? Let's look at how it happened, and then comb the sands of that barren desert for clues. Again, Bryce's parents assert that the issue with his abuse of alcohol and prescription drugs was something that began when he returned to school in August 2013, and was not apparent at all during his time in their home the preceding summer. Yet they don't know that to be a fact. It's an assumption. And that assumption is based in perception. Bryce didn't appear to have a problem. When he got to college, it was immediately apparent, well within the first 2 weeks of arrival, that he was experiencing a severe psychological issue that caused him to indulge unreasonable amounts of alcohol and prescription pills, to the extent his roommate and girlfriend are going to alert his parents and do so on more than one occasion. Yet, when Bryce talks to his parents, what do they say? There doesn't seem to be anything wrong with him. He seems lucid. So when the roommate calls Bryce's parents, and they subsequently confront Bryce, he denies there's a problem. And they believe him because he sounds okay. So what we really need to do is stomp on the brakes and bring this thing to a screeching halt, to observe what's happening in the subtext of these interactions between Bryce's roommate and his parents, in addition to those between Bryce's girlfriend Kim and his parents. While the situation with his roommate precedes the one with the girlfriend, what's true of both incidents is that Bryce's parents ignore the warnings of two people who care about him in favor of believing Bryce based upon perception. What that says very clearly is that all it ever took for Bryce's parents to believe everything is okay in his life is him insisting it while seeming normal. It's a pattern that repeats right up until the end of the story, at which point he's never seen again. With that said, the obvious conclusion is that everything was not okay. Bryce was hiding something that was causing him increasing emotional distress. Remember the reference I just made to them wanting to always see the sun? Here we have people specifically telling them it's raining in Bryce's life, but they ignore that wisdom and go straight to the source to find out instead. And why? Because Bryce is going to tell them he's okay. He always has. They can count on it. That's the mental illness at play in this situation. It enhances the mystery of an event that shouldn't be so complicated. We shouldn't be talking about Bryce being intercepted by a serial killer in the middle of the night. One thing I find really interesting is that when people involved in such a situation try to misdirect the reality of the root of the problem by way of perception, what often happens is that the very nature of that action dictates that you'll need to create perception to accommodate. So much like the Mara Murray case, there is a propensity to include a phantom third party in this event, despite no evidence of that occurring. People want to know who Bryce was meeting that night, and why. There are suggestions that somebody else might have been driving his vehicle. But it's garbage. All of it. This is a story of isolation, of evolution psychologically cornering a young man with the prospect of change, and refusing to allow re-entry to society until the truth is revealed. Truth precipitates change. Lies only support a false truth that caters to perception. At the bottom of this barrel is our greatest fear. Loss. Before Bryce even gets in his car on that day, it's already a fact he won't tell his parents what's going on with him because he's afraid of loss. But the truth is he actually has nothing to lose but perception. Admitting the problem and acting to correct it, or at least manage it properly, is a big win for anybody who's suffering. And the reason is because it's a step in the right direction. Evolution will reward you for seeking truth because it requires bringing light to darkness. It will then step aside, allow you out of the corner, and permit you to join society once again. When you're suffering emotionally and make the decision to reconnect with other people in favor of isolating yourself from society, you shower the world with your light. Nature relies on you to behave. We call it Mother Nature because she is your parent. She's our parent. She loves us no differently than we do our children. How do you think we learn to raise kids? That's the manual you don't get when you sign up for parenthood. It's simple in theory, dreadful in practice, because of one factor that makes us all cringe. And that's the reality that when we run toward the light, the truth is always illuminated, for better or worse. It's out there for everybody to see, doused in confusion, shame, and stifling paranoia. The Scarlet Letter is not just a work of fiction. It's a reality we live every day. We fear the repercussions of our mistakes will be permanent, especially in terms of perception. And this is why. Identity goes a long way in determining our societal worth. Just like any filing system predicated upon perceived value, we create labels as shortcuts for understanding who we are as individuals. For instance, people might know you as a trash collector, a pediatrician, a ventriloquist, a manipulator, murderer, rapist, preacher, daycare attendant, sociopath, mother, cousin, crazy, unstable, loving, desired, ugly, indifferent, desperate, and so on. In society, we work tirelessly to try to control the perception of others. We endeavor to limit what they know, mostly sticking to a facade of positivity, simply because positivity, success, and happiness indicate the creation of abundant light. We want them to see health, happiness, and a reason to envy our lives, all in an effort to get their attention. Because their attention equates to what? Light. That's how we establish alphas, and the pecking order of humanity in general. We ask a simple question. How much light can you attract? And you have two ways of answering that question. One is through perception, the other is action. What you look like and what you do are two sides of the same coin, perception and action. Perception feeds societal concerns, and action fuels evolutionary requirements. You are equally entitled to utilizing both, simply by default of your humanity, but here's where the problem arises. Using one to conceal the other leads to inevitable tragedy. If you use perception to conceal action that renders darkness, you wake a sleeping monster called evolution. If you poke the beehive, it swarms. Because you're fucking with the architecture of life, the infrastructure of being. And the brilliance of the plan is that humanity is not designed to accommodate it. So we fight back. Now let's dig a bit deeper into the science of perception. Perception, at the core of its functionality, is the half-life of the results of your actions that radiates out into society as the light is detected through the process of formation, expansion, and dissipation, or retraction if you prefer. In the same way as an atomic explosion, the energy is formed by way of taking the action to make a bomb It expands by way of an impact that causes an explosion of light, and then dissipates, or retracts, to nothingness. So let's look at an example of how this would happen over the course of a person's entire life, using a talented basketball player as our model. Everything starts as an idea, a mathematical probability, just like our world. We have a kid with athletic talents conducive to excelling in basketball. One day he thinks he should try playing the game, so he picks up a ball and dribbles. That's his first action. Now watch the light radiate outward. This little boy dribbles the ball, which causes sound to travel, alerting evolution to his actions. One of his parents sees him doing it, and notices he's performing the task very well for a novice. She then turns to the other parent, who's approaching in the distance, and smiles while pointing at their kid dribbling the basketball. The father smiles, approaches, and calls out words of encouragement to the boy. Some older boys nearby practicing on the baseball diamond hear him shouting to his wife, and follow his eyes to the boy dribbling the ball. They see how well he's doing it, and stop playing. They start discussing the kid's skills, their eyes fixed on him. Realizing they're impressed by what they see, this kid starts to shoot the ball and finds equal success. A mom arriving to pick up her son from baseball practice sees what's happening and calls her husband, a basketball coach, to report what she sees. Soon enough, there's a crowd watching and the coach arrives in his car to offer the boy a spot on the team. Everybody seems to want his attention. When he gets home that night and isn't taking any action but sleeping in his bed, the phone starts ringing with offers of free tuition at private schools for his athletic services in exchange. It becomes apparent to mom and dad that he's garnering attention even when he's not on the court. He's perceived a certain way. He can go to bed at night rest assured people are still going to think of him as the kid with the basketball skills. The potential for his light to reach outward is nearly unlimited. And so with that, just like when a bomb blows up, his light continually expands outward until his skills and popularity reach their peak as an adult, extending right through elementary school, high school, college, and the professional ranks, until which time he's physically unable to perform at a level where his light will continue to expand in the hero-worshipping eyes of mortals. His skills will diminish, and do so in direct proportion to a loss of speed in his actions, the specific element that defines evolutionary thrust. So his explosion of light continues outward until he reaches the peak of his athletic success, at which point he'll only be able to accommodate a decreasing amount of light every day moving forward. His skills will erode from this point on, and other heroes, just like other stars in the sky, will take his place as his enormous circle of light surrounding him begins to recede like floodwaters after a storm. Think of it this way. If you have a pen light, one of those little flashlights that allows you to adjust the beam from a dot all the way out to an expansive circle, and then back again, that's the equivalent not only of what happened during the Big Bang, but also perfectly represents what happens as the result of our actions. Now, here's where perception comes into play, in terms of being the half-life of your actions. Perception builds you a reputation through your actions, enhances it while the light expands outward, and then maintains it as the light fully retracts. Accordingly, the narrative would then go like this. The boy is discovered as being a player with great potential. His light expands outward with his actions until that potential reaches its peak, allowing maximum action to produce maximum light at the height of this energy source, illuminating a world that seeks such divinity to attain peace. However, as the person ages and proves himself mortal by slowing down and being unable to stop the recession of light until his life finally ends, the actions that created his reputation are no longer taking place. But just like an explosion, in the aftermath of the action, you're still able to see the profound effect it rendered, and specifically in the form of light caused by the explosion. So, to summarize, positive actions create light that expands outward and subsequently affords the benefit of residual perception that aids our reputation. If there's no creation of light in this endeavor, though, evolution calls bullshit. So as it pertains to our story here today, What this means is that Bryce Laspisa is not going to get away with trying to create perception that's contrary to his actions. He's going to get his ass kicked up and down the block by Evolution, with all the neighbors watching, and still proceed in telling people he won the fight. You can't genuinely turn negative actions into positive emotions. You have to pretend everything is okay in that situation. And pretending forces others to perceive you for having taken positive actions and spreading copious light, when in fact, you haven't. You've drawn them into darkness, away from the light, with falsehoods. That's the antithesis of evolution. But that lie will eat your insides. The reason is that evolution inverts the light and illuminates the truth inside you in the same way as the explosion, but it implodes inward until you finally crumble. And it's because you can't hide from the light. Simply because it's all you are. Just like the stars. Burning. Raging on the inside. Negative energy can be released by disseminating light through positive action, or suppressed in favor of inaction. Our world is nothing more than the movement of light. Any falsification of the transfer of light is a big no-no when operating under the umbrella of evolution. That's why it's relegated to the entertainment world, where we regularly manipulate light to create abstractions of reality. It's okay when we recognize it's only fantasy. When we try to falsify the transfer of light in reality, the truth wilts. And what are we searching for with this light? Beyond anything else? Truth. Where do we come from? Who are we? And where are we going on this journey? And so, it's obviously no coincidence whatsoever that Bryce Laspisa's last night on Earth mimics that experience exactly. He goes off the side of the road in darkness along his journey, having waited for the light of day to retract fully before losing his way and literally going straight downhill. His means of movement, in the form of his vehicle, becomes disabled, and his light then dissipates until he vanishes. This was a predetermined event, not in terms of specificity, but with intention. Bryce was going to follow the symbolism in a time and place that rendered the most similarity to his emotional pain. Metaphorical implications made him snap. There isn't much of a mystery in that. Mara Murray experienced the same. So let's map out the events of that fateful day, both factually and emotionally. We're going to track Bryce's movements in the context of evolutionary implications in order to have a better understanding of where he went after crashing the vehicle. I contend that this event happened of his own volition, whether planned or spontaneous, and did not involve the presence of another individual, either in the vehicle with Bryce or interfering with him along his path. I believe this was the culmination of his emotional suffering, not a random event. And that conclusion is derived from the psychology inherent in his choices. So let's examine them. Here we go. Bryce is at Sierra College on August 29th, preparing to head out on the journey. So right away we should note that Sierra College is actually a community college, and Bryce lives a 7-hour drive from it. He's not exactly part of the community. There's a plethora of community colleges in Southern California, closer to his home. Community college isn't normally the type of place where you travel close to 500 miles to attend classes and live. What that insinuates to me is that Bryce moved with his parents because he didn't possess the resources to finance an independent life, but wanted to get away from them as soon as he did. Now, that's perfectly normal for a young guy his age, but given the fact that he was a good student and referred to as very bright, even to the extent that he was a talented artist, it seems odd that he had no college plans. The move wasn't spontaneous, and was planned for after his high school graduation. So he had time to anticipate this, but makes no plans for the future. He doesn't enroll in Sierra College until after he moves with Mom and Dad. It almost seems like he didn't have a plan, wasn't going to do anything, and then finally decided, when it came down to having to make a choice, that he wanted to get away from his parents in the lowest pressure situation possible. I noticed, unlike many community colleges across the country, Sierra doesn't charge higher tuition for those living outside the county where the institution is located. Right away, we can see this isn't going to be a difficult sell for Bryce. The tuition is dirt cheap, and the academic requirements aren't going to be overwhelming for him. So what we can observe from that is that he doesn't want to achieve his potential in comparison to the glowing reviews of him as a high school student. And he also doesn't want to have high expectations placed upon him, or pressure, expressed very well by the fact that most classes at this school, even to this day, still cost less than $150 per semester. If you're Karen and Michael Laspisa, and your son fails out of such a school, the hit to your wallet is nothing. A full-time student would spend between $600 and $750 for tuition, on average. This place is 7 hours from his parents' house. He isn't fooling me. I've been this shitty student and depressed person. My college was a 6-hour drive. And why? So I could get away and party to mask my problems. But I suffered from guilt. And guess why? Because the tuition was a lot more than what Bryce's parents paid. Had I been more depressed, perhaps at the end of my rope, and knew my attempt at graduating from a university was just a ploy to deceive people, I'd likely have opted for the same thing as Bryce. His parents supposedly felt like this was a good move for him, but apparently offered the notion that they understood it meant that they wouldn't be seeing much of him on the weekends. Obviously, if you choose a far-off community college with low academic requirements and low tuition, one that is a terribly inconvenient 7-hour drive from your retired parents, the inference is that you're mitigating risk in relation to your activities at school. You don't want them to see or know about what you're doing or how you're feeling. Hidden within this is the pain of something unbearable. And I believe Bryce was reaching a point where he could no longer maintain the facade. The dam was about to break, and the floodwaters of the truth were going to come crashing through that indestructible wall he'd so carefully crafted his whole life. He said to his mom that day that he had something he needed to tell her. He never did. Not on the phone, and not when he arrived home. He couldn't even bring himself to go there again. The only thing he had left to offer was the truth. Yet, Bryce was too scared to face it. But when that day came, he could lie no more. So, throughout Bryce's first year at Sierra College, he only came home for major breaks and holidays. But after the school year, he had to go home for the summer. Again, his parents report nothing unusual in his behavior, no signs of drug use. But in the 2 weeks after returning to school, he's drinking heavily, taking Vyvanse, giving away his valuable personal belongings, breaking up with his girlfriend, and telling his mother Karen that he has, quote, a lot to tell her. In fact, Bryce has so much to tell her on the night of August 28th around 11:30 p.m. that he forgoes the ride home to his apartment from Kim's place, instead opting to get on Interstate 5 heading south toward his parents' house. Clearly, Bryce is acting desperately, and something is bothering him to an extent it's causing severe anxiety. Whatever he needs to tell his parents, it can't wait. So he starts driving in the middle of the night. Yet with the trek being 7 hours, and perhaps less with no traffic due to the time, Bryce never arrives in Laguna Niguel. He's actually broken down on the side of the road in a remote area called Button Willow, California, where he receives gas from a State Farm roadside service. This happens at 9 a.m. on August 29th, meaning that Bryce has already been on the road for 9.5 hours to complete what is a 7-hour drive. If you factor in the time his vehicle was incapacitated due to an empty gas tank, he still should have been home by then. But he's not even close. He's still about 180 miles or 2 hours and 45 minutes, away from his destination. And keep in mind that he was so desperate to get there, he told his mother he had a lot to tell her, and just spontaneously left at night. But now that he's on the road, we already see two things. One is that he's unwilling to go to the destination he so desperately felt he needed to only hours earlier, avoiding it to the point of pulling off I-5 and circling until he ran out of gas. And the other is that he's also unwilling to go back from where he came. He remains here, stuck, broken down on the side of the road with no fuel to move, in between two places, where he remains entirely indifferent about his plight in life. And what does that mirror? Emotionally, physically, and spiritually? Purgatory. Bryce is stuck in between, rendered impotent by his simultaneous inability to face the truth and hide it. Hiding it is back at college, but he began to fail in that plight, so he ran. Facing it happens with Mom and Dad when he returns home. But upon running, he learns that choice is equally as painful. So he stops and waits. But that's when it closes in. The shadow. The darkness. When you stop moving. So here's where we get our first strong clue as to the answer in this riddle. If you recall my reference to the archaeology of nature earlier, this is what I mean. We're digging down to the bedrock of the truth, which is spelled out perfectly in the symbolic impressions found within the secrets that are buried down there. Anyhow, the symbolism tells this narrative. Unable to go ahead in life as an adult in college, Bryce embarked on a journey back to his childhood to reclaim the freedom of innocence, only to stop when he realized it was nothing more than an illusion. He could never go back. Not to his parents' house, and not to school. So he wasn't going to complete the journey he started. He was just going to turn in circles. In his mind, and in his 2003 Toyota Highlander, until he ran out of gas emotionally, and in the context of the SUV. Of course, guess what happens? Bryce, even after getting the gas in his vehicle from roadside assistance, refuses to go on. He literally sits in that spot for hours without moving. And why? Simply because he can't refill his emotional gas tank. The kid is done. I mean that in the nicest way. Sincerely. But he had to be rescued. Nobody came. It's not anybody's fault but his, though. He deceived them until the end. Now, Bryce is still telling his mom everything is fine, even though he should have been home hours ago. She ends up contacting the service he used to get the gas and asks them to relay a message to the service guy who helped Bryce to call her. He does just that and reports that while Bryce's eyes seem to be a little red, something that would naturally be expected of a person who drove all night, he otherwise seemed okay, meaning he wasn't intoxicated or suffering distress. So in a situation where it's already going to be difficult to explain these circumstances upon arriving in Laguna Niguel, Bryce ups the ante on that notion by not arriving later that morning, or that afternoon, or even later that night. He's still going to be on the road past 4 a.m. the following day. Purgatory, my friends. The truth that he needs to come to terms with is that, in the context of the long road of the journey of life, the only path is through. Death is the only way out. Bryce sits on the side of the road all day, and even after being discovered by this guy from roadside assistance, and later the police, he's not going to stop sitting on the side of the road or driving in circles until he decides to drive down a hillside, hitting the accelerator, and finally making a decision about what he really wants. It fails, as he's obviously no stunt driver with experience navigating such terrain. And when it does, he takes off before suffering consequences that will prevent him from what he really wants, which is the death that will cause him to disappear, just like his misguided intention of driving the vehicle into the lake to end it all. Now that he's on foot, the goal is easier to attain. He's smaller and less noticeable. It's not a perfect plan, but with two cracks at it, he just might succeed this way. And now for the element that just makes me grin every time I read about it. The tracking dogs used to look for Bryce, in the days after his disappearance, were able to track his scent. And where did it lead? There's only one location possible. A gas station. The trail stops there, because Bryce Laspisa ran out of gas, in every way, forever. Of course, this location is also a truck stop, so some people believe he hitched a ride with a trucker, but I think Bryce had proven he didn't want to go anywhere with anyone. So let's comb through the events of August 28th through the 29th, leading into the early morning hours after 4 a.m. on August 30th, when the truck flips and leaves us asking where Bryce went and what his fate ultimately became. Conversations he has with law enforcement and his mother prove quite revealing. Right before Bryce leaves on this journey, on the night of the 28th, is when his girlfriend Kim takes the keys to his truck, refuses to give them back, and subsequently calls his mother. She does this, of course, for the same reason as his college roommate Sean, meaning that she knows he's been drinking heavily and taking the ADHD drug Vyvanse. Now, I believe Sean knew about the Vyvanse as well, but only disclosed the drinking issue when alerting Bryce's parents. It seems his intention was to point out a problem, limiting the invasion of privacy. But here's Kim, long after that revealing call with Sean takes place, telling Bryce's mom that he's not fit to drive, that something is wrong with him. Instead of believing Kim, she asks to speak to Bryce, who tells her Kim is just mad because he broke up with her. So Karen asks to speak to Kim again and says that Bryce seems to be fine. She goes on to instruct Kim to return the keys so Bryce can drive home to his apartment, as he's been saying repeatedly that's what he wants. And what happens? Kim gives the keys back in a situation where Karen allowed the facts presented by Kim and Sean about Bryce's state of mind to take a back seat to the perception Bryce offered her by insisting he's fine. He offers no evidence of such, contrary to the people who can verify by way of fact that he's been drinking heavily and taking Vyvanse, yet Karen chooses to believe Bryce. Look what happens. He takes the keys, goes on some ludicrous two-day ride with no sleep, drives down a hillside in what appears to be a misguided suicide attempt, and disappears into thin air, never to be seen again, dead or alive. That's reality. Bryce, even after knowing Sean placed a call to his mother divulging his condition, sends Sean a text explicitly telling his roommate that he's, quote, the coolest person I've ever known. So what we see here is that Sean and Kim were not only willing to acknowledge the situation, but wanted it to come to the surface so he could get help. Look who stands in the way of that. Bryce and his parents. They fight it. With denial. And it's going to continue right up until the end. It gives us a perfect portrait of what was going on in this household. Because the Vyvanse, combined with the drinking, might have been Bryce's demise, but it wasn't the impetus for the problem. That was in his head. That was the thing he couldn't tell them about. Kim and Sean wanted to open that door. They wanted Bryce to get help. And what did his mother want him to do? To get away from Kim. To get his keys. To flee. First to his apartment, then to Mom's house, where a denial would suffice. Just like it had all summer. Because having children is frightening. When they're five and they scrape a knee, you can wash it, slap on a Band-Aid, and add a kiss on top to make everything better. But when he's 19, drinking, abusing drugs, and thinking of suicide, there's nothing you can do but love him and hope he makes the right choice. It's easier to believe everything's okay. It's more comforting to deny. We all do it. Anyhow, Bryce stops answering his mom's calls the next morning. She became concerned when learning of the roadside assistance because it was through her insurance company, which supposedly placed a call to verify the service with the account holder. This is when Karen learns Bryce didn't go home to his apartment the night before. He got on the road heading toward her house. She missed a call from him around 1 a.m., and we assume that might have been the subject he intended to discuss. So she learns he's in Button Willow by way of the insurance company, and as discussed, later gets a call from the service guy reporting that Bryce is still in the same spot, hours after receiving the gas. Now, the service guy puts Bryce on the phone with Karen, who asks him what he's doing. He says nothing. She asks why he's in Button Willow when he should have been home hours ago, and can't get an answer that satisfies the question. He says he's fine, but clearly he's not. He can't move. He simply can't go on. So Karen tells him that he's only about 3 hours from home, and he just needs to get more gas in the truck to make the rest of the drive. Bryce says okay, they hang up, and the service guy leaves. But Bryce doesn't. He sits there, for hours, again, moving a total of 8 miles that day, but remaining in the same town. Now, his mother already knows he hasn't moved in hours from a spot where he just got gas, and hadn't moved from that spot for hours prior, because he ran out of gas and didn't do anything to get more. So how many fucking times will he need to do this before she gets the message that he isn't going anywhere? Something is terribly wrong, and he's in the midst of having a breakdown. Notice the symbolism. He breaks down in the truck. He breaks down psychologically. But watch the denial ensue. Bryce's mother starts calling him again later when he doesn't arrive by the time he should have, given that he told her he was going to leave the location in Button Willow in favor of heading to her house. Yet he doesn't answer her calls. She's getting really worried. So what does she do? She files a missing persons report with the state police. But Bryce isn't missing. He's still sitting in the same fucking spot on the side of the road at 6 p.m., hours after the service guy makes his second trip to the scene. Of course, instead of Karen just suggesting to police that he might still be there, she asks them to ping his cell phone to determine his location. And guess where he ends up being? That's right. Bryce Laspisa is sitting on the side of the road in his truck at 6 p.m. in Button Willow, 8 miles from the last spot, and 9 hours after getting gas from the service guy. That's when the police arrive and question him. He passes the field sobriety test, seems coherent, and has nothing illegal in the vehicle, as far as the cops can tell. They have no reason to detain him, despite the fact that something is clearly not right. And that's because it's not illegal to descend into psychosis. You can be as crazy as you want, as long as you don't present a threat to yourself or anybody else. So they let him go. But not before suggesting he calls home. After being fully cooperative, Bryce is suddenly hesitant and won't make the call. So the cops call for him. They put him on the phone with his mother, and she asks what he's doing. And like most people who are desperate to manipulate the thoughts of others to defer suspicion, Bryce tells her what he's doing right at that moment, rather than the truth about the grand scheme of this outrageous, nonsensical journey he's undergone. The reason people do that is that it satisfies truth, even if not the one the person asking the question requested to know. Bryce says he's putting things back in his car after the cops searched it, which is true, but leaves Karen ignorant. And you already know what's going to happen here. Despite the fact that something is clearly wrong, what does Karen do? She sides with the cops because they decided, based upon perception and not fact, that there's nothing wrong with Bryce. But the facts show he's suffering, feeling trapped, and unable to do anything but turn in circles. Why would he do anything else moving forward? Well, the answer is he wouldn't. And he doesn't. So, Karen takes the word of the cops, and once again expects Bryce to drive home. But we already know that ain't happening. There's no chance in hell. About an hour later, the service guy from earlier in the day realizes he has a missed call from Karen and calls her to learn about what happened with the police. He offers to go back out and drive around to see if Bryce has actually left the area to go home, and finds the young man sitting where the police stopped him. He still hasn't moved. So this guy gets out and tells Bryce he needs to get home, that he's going to follow him onto the highway to make sure he's moving okay. Bryce agrees, but notice what we have here. It's forced movement. He's not running towards something. He's running away. He's being chased. We already know that as soon as he's out of this guy's sight, he's going to stop the journey. Accordingly, 10 miles later, after following Bryce the whole way, the guy pulls off the highway and calls Karen to report that Bryce is on the road heading home. Of course, at 12:30 a.m., Bryce gets off the highway to buy gas and a drink. His mom calls soon after, but he doesn't answer. She calls again just before 2 a.m., and this time Bryce picks up the phone. Both of his parents are asking his location, but he's being evasive, even to the extent that he claims to not be able to see any landmarks or signs along I-5 because it's too dark. But he's not on I-5 and refuses to give his location, so he just says his GPS suggests he'll be home around 3:30 a.m. 20 minutes later, Bryce calls his parents back and says he's going to pull off the road to sleep. For me, this is mind-blowing and a very definitive statement. Bryce has been on a journey where he refuses to go on and can't go back, and now, in the process of circling, stopping, and repeating the pattern indefinitely, has realized the truth. This is the end of the road. It's come time for him to rest. So when he makes this call to his parents, notice that previously they weren't able to get a hold of him by calling multiple times, yet now he's trying to get their attention, and it just so happens to be the last time anybody ever hears from him. The most likely scenario is that he decided to die, ultimately did, and got the rest from this unknown thing that had haunted him every moment of his waking life. He tells his mother that he's going to pull over to get some sleep, and she responds by saying it's a good idea, because he's obviously tired from the trip. The symbolism is apparent, and bolstered by the fact he's never seen again, after engaging what appears to be a truly desperate and misguided attempt at suicide. Around 8 a.m. the next morning, Bryce's parents have law enforcement knocking at their door, at which point they learn about the incident where his truck flips. They're informed the vehicle came to rest on an access road next to Castaic Lake. It had rumbled down the embankment above, starting by a cell tower at the top. Again, police indicate that rocks kicked up by the tires along the way, combined with the tracks themselves, suggest Bryce hit the gas pedal the whole way down. Moreover, he doesn't swerve back and forth as though he suddenly regained consciousness, or woke up, and realized he went off the side of the road. Surveillance photos taken by a nearby camera that checks license plates indicate that the vehicle passed by the location twice before going down the hill on the third pass. If you consider that logically, it's akin to a little system we often utilize that I'll describe as, quote, on three, for lack of a better term. As our lives exist within the framework of a three-act structure, birth, life, and death, our choices often follow suit. In fact, literature, movies, plays, and so on, no matter how many acts they might include in their structure, still must adhere to the notion of birth, life, death. There can be another rebirth and 792 sequels, but we, like flowers, blossom, struggle to maintain striking beauty in spite of the elements, and then wither to our deaths. If we're cliff diving while on vacation, or skydiving 12,000 feet up in the air, we might jump on the count of three. In fact, everybody knows about the joke where someone doesn't want to do something that a friend's doing, but they agreed to do it together on the count of three, only to have the willing friend push the hesitant one early on the count of two, because it's funny. Because it was unexpected. We have expectations of experiencing things in a three-act structure. Birth, life, death. Your kid's toys. They open the package, play with the toy, and then the toy dies a symbolic death as they grow out of it and pretend it doesn't exist anymore. Notice how popular it is to forgive people and give them second chances, even though they already harmed you in some way? But nobody would ever suggest that a third chance is appropriate, even though the circumstance is the same, because a third mistake symbolically equates to death. And you fear going there. You're willing to get hurt twice, but not three times, because Act 3 is the end. We say things like, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. But there's no concession for what happens the third time. Death is always implied. Three strikes in baseball, and you're out. It's always implied that you have to change on the third go-round of the same circumstance. And here's Bryce coming up the hill for the third time. The first two times he just kept on going, and nothing changed in his life. He remained in purgatory. The third time Bryce went up the hill, he made a choice. He took action. And if the third act equates to death, and Bryce hasn't been seen since, then his death in this story was one without hope for a rebirth. It was a tragedy. So, Castaic Lake is combed over the course of 4 days by divers. But they find nothing. Search teams cover an area of approximately 11 square miles. Yet, no signs of Bryce. All potential sightings of him since that time have been debunked by police. So if there's anything positive to be taken from the story, it's that Bryce knows the peace he sought, regardless of how he may have ended up there, alive or dead. He isn't forced to hide, or to wander in circles halfway between living and dying. He can rest. And in the end, for better or worse, that's what we're all seeking. We just have to come to realize the truth. That's what happened to Bryce Laspisa. He stayed on the road for so long that the time was coming that he'd be forced to rest. Understanding the implications of the symbolism, he chose that moment. Bryce was looking for a way out, not through. That's why he couldn't continue. When he accepted what was entirely evident, that his journey was over, notice the truck finally goes downhill off the road, and Bryce Laspisa is never seen again. But we still don't know why. What was so bad it couldn't be fixed? He's gone now, so his parents don't know. Neither does his girlfriend, or his roommate. He wouldn't tell them what was wrong. He just simply could not bring himself to do it. And why? Perception. The half-life of his actions. Everything he'd worked for. Bryce was known as a friendly, popular, and outgoing young guy with a big smile. Somebody described as the type of person who could light up a room with his personality and charm. He was likable, and also talented, athletically, academically, and artistically. This is how he's known. But just like any other person, when you reveal yourself as something less than what you were even a moment ago, when you divulge something is wrong, you get knocked down the evolutionary ladder. If you're an attorney who gives magnificent closing arguments, and then suffer an accident or illness that causes you to have a speech impediment, that becomes part of the new you. Something perceived by others as less than what you were before it happened. If you're the most respected, humble person in your office, and suddenly have an outrageous meltdown one day, your reputation is toast. So the bottom line is that we always try to control perception, despite reality. We hide mental illness because it generally can't be seen the same way as a rash. It's lurking beneath the surface. But when it comes through, when it's severe enough, it rises. It's seen. And there's no going back from it. Once people think you're crazy, you are. You can seek help and recover, but then the perception of you is that you went crazy, sought help, and recovered. That's what they remember. They don't allow you the perception from before you went crazy. That event haunts the perception of you for the rest of your existence. This happens even for the most ridiculous reasons, especially with young people. I recall a guy shitting his pants in high school. That's who he was and will always be to me until I stop breathing. I don't care if he's on the next presidential election ballot. He shit his pants. That's him. In sixth grade, a classmate smoked a grapevine in the boys' room, passed out, and had to be taken to the hospital. He was then out of school for no less than 6 weeks to, quote, recover, when in reality, he wasn't a drug addict and wasn't injured. He was kept from school in order to not suffer the fallout from the perception. But guess what? The whispers were just as loud. And he went on to do a million things in his life that were not passing out in the bathroom in sixth grade. But I still remember him specifically for being that person. I never let go of that perception. And so, if you reverse the situation and look at it from Bryce's position, he knows his mental state is spiraling out of control. He's reaching the point where he can't hide it very well anymore, and knows soon he won't be able to hide it at all. The perception of him is already changing. Sean thinks there's something wrong. So does his girlfriend. And what does he do? He abandons them immediately to head toward his parents, who are still willing to give him the benefit of the doubt. But due to his actions, their perception starts to change as well, and he knows home isn't a safe option either. So he chooses the temporary solution of a purgatory where nobody knows him, and therefore can't judge with any lasting measure. But here's why purgatory doesn't work. We can walk on solid ground in our lives, or even reach up for the stars. But to be suspended in one place is imprisonment. And the only way to be released from the purgatory, from the place where you're suspended in midair, is to let go. With that, what you come to understand is that the thing holding you there is invisible. And it isn't the least bit tangible. It's perception. That's why you're floating, circling, searching desperately for Act 3. So Bryce did it. He let go of perception. With the stakes higher than ever, he let go. And he was free, liberated from it all. He would never suffer our stare. He would never suffer the whispers, or even thoughts about what could have been. If we compare this event to something like the disappearance of Emma Filipov, what we notice is that Emma had a personality more conducive to wandering and being a free-spirited transient type. As she descended into psychosis, it didn't seem all that odd to other people that she was behaving in new and strange ways because it fit her personality type. It wasn't until she began having conversations with herself and claiming furniture was talking to her that anybody questioned it. With Bryce, however, he's expected to be cool and normal, sporting the latest Nike shoes and other sorts of athletic wear a guy his type would wear. His appearance and outlook revolve around fitting into a specific social group predicated upon popularity, not living alone in a tree. He wasn't a strange guy. So his illness was going to become very noticeable, and do so very quickly. He felt out of control and confused, especially because telling his parents meant that he was going to have to be that person in their eyes every day for the rest of time. But the problem started before using Vyvanse. It prompted use, as with drinking. So obviously, we can't speak to Bryce. We can't ask him what prompted this. But what I can do, and what I did, is examine every picture of this young man I could find online. I zoomed in on them, expanded them so that I only saw his eyes, and then reduced them to original size and did the same once again to each. What I noticed immediately, and expected to find, is that Bryce's eyes are glazed over in almost every one, almost sinking in the sockets, like an optical sunset. Not in the sense that he's high on something, but that these eyes betray the big smile that he flashes in the pictures. He naturally has a big mouth, and so a large toothy grin isn't very difficult for him to achieve. The smile draws attention to it. But if you ignore his smile and stare into his eyes, it's clear that they're dead. The flame has gone out on something back there, and darkness entered in its wake. When a person smiles, it begins with the eyes because they receive the information the brain computes to cause the smile to happen in the first place. The sight of something eye-catching can cause the pupils to change size, but the person has no control of that function. On the other hand, people regularly fake smiles by doing nothing more than turning the corners of their mouth upward. And if you're Bryce Laspisa, somebody with the perfect mouth for sending a big smile, it's easy to distract viewers from the truth your eyes didn't precipitate a genuine action. Something was wrong. There was chaos in that young man's eyes. They literally looked like they were sinking in a fog. But he kept smiling and saying it was okay. The result says it wasn't. Bryce took the half-life on people's perception of him as far as he could go, right up until it dissipated, died, and began a rebirth with him descending into psychosis on the back of drug and alcohol abuse. That was a narrative he simply couldn't defend, or at least, he didn't want to go that route. So he jumped ship. For good. At the end of our road, however, the mystery of what happened to Bryce remains a curiosity. Only he knows the truth. From what ignited these feelings within him in the first place, to the location where he finally met an unknown fate. But in researching this tale, it reminded me of a time years ago when I experienced something similar, though obviously nothing of Bryce's magnitude. I was young, and working at a job I knew didn't offer a future for me, in terms of a career. I felt a lot of pressure to get out of there, and was also dealing with some unresolved feelings about events in my personal life. To put it bluntly, I sort of cracked. Now, I didn't go on a maniacal 30-hour journey with no destination, but it started with quitting my job. I didn't have another lined up, and had rent to pay, but I left anyhow. I just couldn't do it. I broke, and for reasons I didn't understand. But things got worse because I had no money. So one day I got a part-time job in a terrible neighborhood, and the work was equally awful. It was a new low for me. But that's when I injured my back one weekend and was in excruciating pain every day thereafter. So I returned to this horrifying job the next week, badly injured, and realized that what had started as barely tolerable was now going to drive me off a cliff. With all the pain, the job was the worst thing I'd ever experienced. I started to doubt myself. I got depressed, angry, confused. But I let it go on. The rage built inside me, not toward anyone else, toward myself. But it wasn't suicidal thoughts, or guilt, or anything close to that. I was lost. I didn't know where to go. I didn't know how to ask for help. And I didn't want people to think I was crazy. So I didn't do anything about it. I kept on living, which equated to suffering. And one morning, while driving to this job, I felt a tsunami of anxiety wash over my body. It was instantaneous and devastating. The damage was immediately apparent, physically and emotionally. My hands were shaking on the steering wheel, and in the course of a minute, I had descended into a personal hell from which it felt like I'd never return. I pulled my car over to the side of the road and watched life go on without me. I began sweating. My palms, my face, everywhere. And thinking, I can't do it. I can't go on. I couldn't go to that job. In fact, I couldn't even move. I was frozen in fear and shaking. That shaking wouldn't go away. I couldn't go on, but I couldn't turn back. I was suspended there, hovering in place, in my mind, in the car, in a dream. I had become the thing I feared. The shadow, the darkness. It caught up to me, consumed me. There was nowhere to run or hide from this invisible monster. Not even in daylight. The problem was in my head, in my body, poisoning me. I had to get out. Unlike Bryce Laspisa, and probably just because I was a bit older and more mature, I got out my phone. I even dropped it a few times from shaking so badly. But I made a call. I remember dialing my father, knowing he was available at that time of day. The phone kept ringing, but he finally picked up. Yet I said nothing. There was only silence. And then he repeated my name in question form. It was then that, somehow, I found the courage to say it, and to do it the only way I could. I managed these two words. I can't. And he asked what was wrong. I hesitated and could think of only one thing to say. I couldn't articulate it, so I just said, I can't move. But he kept prodding me to elaborate. So I responded, I'm on the side of the road. I can't move. I told him I couldn't go to work. I couldn't go home. I could only remain there. I knew somehow he would understand. Because I remembered a time when he was that person, broken down on the side of the road. And he did understand. Because we're all that person, at some time, in some strange place in our heads, and on the map. But he said that everything was going to be fine, that I should stay right there as long as I needed to recover, that it would pass eventually, like all things seem to. And it did. Not forever. just for that moment. Just long enough to see the sun. To see somebody smile. To hear a laugh. And to remind myself it would all be okay. That never happened to me again. Because once it did, I saw the truth. I was lost. I needed help. To think, to grow, to love, to change course, and just let go of it all. Especially perception. Because in the end, we are not perfect. We are tragic and beautiful, scared and hopeful. But above all else, we are not long for this world. So in the meantime, stay on the path, follow the light, and always keep moving.